I read once part where you got pulled over by the cops.
Hey, we were at, it was me and a bunch of outlaws, and we were at the Chili Chowder. That's how they pronounce it there. Chili Chowder Festival. And it was actually good food.
Yeah.
We're leaving, and a trooper stops us, and he's giving us the riot act a little bit, but he comes around, and I wasn't trying to be a smart ass. It's just that it came off my tongue real quick. And I am kind of in roll, you know. And he says, hey, you know, your license plate expired. And I said, I guess you got to take that up with Avis. What I got? It's like my car. I rented it. I didn't know to check it, you know. But then he kind of browbeats me a little bit. And I'm all right. In my mind, I'm like, back off a little bit, boy. You come off a little. Dude, look at who you're in a car with right now. And then he was like, well, what are you doing up here hanging out with all these outlaws kind of thing? And he asked if I was a bandito because I was from Texas. I go, banditos and outlaws don't get along. I said, hell, they're my friends. But the way it played is we get to the next bar setting and they're like, you should have heard Tex. He told that effing trooper.
Yeah.
He told him, he was like, you need to check with Avis for that. And I'm like, yeah.
You just built credibility.
Well, I played well, but I could have been easily had my face on the hood of a car.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I tell you what, this is going to be a good one. We're laughing already. We didn't even hit the record button yet. So I want to welcome everybody back. I don't know why you folks continue to come back every week. We're almost here at the end of our fourth year of Game of the Crime, start our fifth year. Couldn't do any of this without you. So thank you so much for coming in. If you haven't checked us out on YouTube, please go over there. Type in Game of Crimes podcast in that search bar. Click on it, hit that subscribe button. That's the really important thing because I'm trying to build a channel this year. That's the goal for 2025. And check out some of our episodes, like, make comments. I'll even take your crappy comments. But let's get on with today's show because we got a lot to cover here. This gentleman I got on the screen here, you might think he's on work release. And maybe he is. I don't know. I'm not sure he's told me everything yet. But you're looking at a 28-year veteran law enforcement officer. A man who spent 5 years with the Greenville County Sheriff's Department in Greenville, South Carolina, good place to be, and then became an FBI special agent for almost 23 years. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Scott Payne to Game of Crime. Scott, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks for having me on, buddy.
Well, I hope you say that at the end of the show. I will see how this all goes. It's starting out really good, so I think this is going to be a good show. And I hit Scott up this morning. I mean, I just talked to this guy last Friday. And today is Tuesday, so what, 5 days? He agreed to be on the podcast here. But I just hit him up this morning about the small-town police blotter. And I had to explain to him what it was. He didn't hesitate. Thumbs up. Here we go. So just to tell you our disclaimer, because we haven't had it on here for a couple of shows, this is a show about crime. This is a place where we talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take our stories very seriously, although we're going to have a lot of laughs, and that's what small-town police blotter is all about, having a laugh at the expense of some of these stupid criminals that are out there. And like we always do, now, Scott here is originally from South Carolina, so I asked him to read one from South Carolina, and you folks know I'm in Florida. We have no shortage of dumb criminals down here, so we'll go with it. Scott, if you would, brother, tell us about this individual in South Carolina. Right.
Here we go. It says it's an older case, but in South Carolina, a man was arrested for applying for a loan so that he could purchase methamphetamine. Yes, you heard that correctly. Maybe not a good time to be completely transparent when you're, but as an addict, if you they're just looking for that next fix. They do make some bad decisions. So here we go. Grady Carson, 58 years old, went to a Carolina Title Loans office in Spartanburg, South Carolina, right next to where I grew up and was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Also, where my buddy is still a lieutenant over narcotics, to secure a loan against his automobile. According to the website, the loan company provides fast cash to deal with an unexpected expense, such as maybe you need some meth, and charges interest rates that begin at 96%. Man, when I read that, I was like, dude, that is not a good loan. 96%.
I need a business like that. I need a business.
I think you're better off dealing with the cartel or the mafia. I mean, I don't know if the VIG's that high.
It is not.
Let's see. Carolina Title Loans employee told cops that Carson, who was pacing back and forth when he filled out the paperwork, told her he needed the money to purchase meth. So since her manager was at another store, the worker faxed, which I'm seeing now, because when I first read fax, I'm like, we're faxing for help? But it was an older case. I'm like, talk about some snail mail, man.
You're not kidding.
Here we go. I'm better off yelling help. But she faxed a help letter to a second employee who contacted the cops. And even more dumb crook news, when he was handcuffed and searched of his pockets, he turned up a glass container with an off-white rock-like substance inside. But Carson stated it was cocaine, but he was not going to smoke it because he did meth.
Hey, man's got standards.
I tell you, I love dumb crook news. But as you know, being in law enforcement, that's kind of what helps us stay in business sometimes, you know?
Yeah, we do get a lot of that low-hanging fruit, don't we?
I'm going to tell you, there was a bank robbery one that I saw, and it was the guy goes in and he writes the bank robbery letter like, "Hey, this is a robbery. Give me all your money," on the back of his pay stub. So when the cops get there, they flip it over and there's all the information. Oh. Yeah, I got a good idea that this is the guy that robbed the bank.
I almost sent you one from South Carolina where a guy went in to rob a bank and they said, "We can't withdraw money unless you got to provide us with your driver's license." And he goes, "Okay," pulls it out and hands it to him. That's why we call them dumb criminals.
Man, bless
thank
their
you
hearts.
For doing that, brother.
Bless
That's
their
good.
Hearts.
All right, so let's get back over here in Florida. I mean, you've probably heard of Florida Man.
Oh, you? Yeah.
Yeah, but this is not a Florida Man story. This actually came off of Fox 35 TV here in Orlando. The Florida deputies in Highland County were stunned when a suspect in the middle of a high-speed chase casually offered them a drink of alcohol, because that's what you do. You want to be nice to the police. So on Saturday, shortly after 3 p.m., deputies responded to the Spring Lake Market after receiving a report that a man, later identified as Richard Smith, we'll call him the idiot, had allegedly stolen multiple items, including alcoholic beverages. Authorities said the 39-year-old Miami man was in a black minivan. You know, that's such a well-known bank robbery or theft vehicle, right? Mom's minivan. He was reportedly driving circles around the store, but sped off when law enforcement arrived. As a result, there was a long high-speed pursuit, which ended in the parking lot of a business at the Sebring Airport during the chase. Now, here's the good part. Smith allegedly held a can of Kettle One vodka spritz out of his vehicle's window as he drove by a deputy that was trying to get him to pull over. "I was just trying to give you a drink. That's it. Come on, dude." Hey. That's what he told the deputies. That was all confirmed with body camera video also. Soon after, deputies said Smith tried to ram two of their patrol vehicles. Now we're getting serious. But ultimately had his tires flattened by law enforcement spike strips.
Oh, yeah.
Just shows you how stupid he is. Smith was then tased. You got to love that. He's just had a crash. He's running from the cops. He gets out. He lights a cigarette. He's having a smoke break. And then decides he's going to buck on the police, and they tase his butt.
Yep.
Ride the lightning, man.
Ride the lightning. That's it.
Now, while he's being handcuffed, Ted Smith asked, what are you arresting me for? And when they told him, he said, "Yeah, but you guys had fun, though, didn't you?"
Yeah.
High-speed chase, always fun.
I'll just say that. I wasn't upset until you turned down my drink offer. That's when I rammed your vehicles.
Yep. Smith faces charges of aggravated assault on law enforcement officer, battery on law enforcement officer, resisting arrest, DUI, refusal to submit to a DUI test, and petty theft. And now this is a little bit shocking. His bond was set at $120,000. I mean, here in Florida, we usually let him go for like $2,000.
Yeah.
You know, because we got so many dumb criminals in jail already. We don't have room for the rest of them. But that's it for this week's Small Town Police Blotter. So thank you, man. I appreciate you playing along there with us, Scott.
Good deal.
Just want to tell everybody how we met. First of all, I want to give a shout out here. You see Beyond the Barrel on the shirt. This is a podcast for a friend of mine, Kenny Williams. He's an interdiction officer up in northern Indiana. Kenny's been going out of his way to really help me out with technical side of things here lately. Got some challenges coming up with some recordings we did in Southern California, but I think it's all going to work out because of Kenny's expertise. So, and I'm actually going to be interviewed on Kenny's show here Thursday night, a couple of days from now. And Kenny was on here episode 197 back in May. So if you haven't listened to his episode, go find out everything you need to know about interdiction and profiling, because you can't call it profiling anymore. So Scott here, I'd heard about Scott for a long time. There's a retired FBI agent, a lady that has her own podcast, is doing very well. Somebody told me I needed to check it out. Honestly, Scott, no offense, but I don't listen to podcasts, especially if I'm going to have somebody on, because I want it to be my ideas, not somebody else's ideas.
Right.
But I did turn that on, and I heard one story, and I thought, man, first of all, this guy talks like me. I understood every word he said, because some of our listeners don't always understand me. And then I reached out to a mutual friend of ours, Dana Ridenour.
Yeah.
Now, Dana was a retired FBI undercover agent, episode 156. She was out in August 5th of 24. And she vouched for you, brother. Believe it or not, she vouched for you. She said you're legit.
That says a lot. That's probably one of the better undercovers I've done then.
Yeah, it worked. It worked. But I love Dana to death, man. She's hilarious. I'm watching her on social media right now, catching fish left and right. She's enjoying life. But I reached out to Scott. He never hesitated, not one bit. He's got a new book out. We're going to talk about a little bit later and tell you where you can find that at. But if you remember, up until about a year ago, I used to have a saying that I've said on every show back when I had a co-host, when Morgan was still here, and it was to get us started into the episode. And I just finished reading his book yesterday. And I'm thinking, that saying needs to come back for this interview. And the saying is, get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. This is going to be, you're going to hear some of the wildest and craziest undercover stories you've ever heard. And you're probably going to be scratching your head thinking, the heck's wrong with this guy? Well, because I kind of thought that too. But then I thought, well, look what you did, idiot. So maybe we're brothers after all. But we're going to talk about outlaw motorcycle gangs. We're going to talk about domestic terrorism, neo-Nazi extremist groups, the Klan. I mean, this is going to be a good one. So let's get rolling here, Scott. If you would just give us an idea about where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, sports in school, did you go to college, that kind of thing, brothers and sisters, wherever you got.
Sure. Only child, which some say explains a lot. Mom said that was enough. Mm-hmm. She's like, that's it, one and done.
You said that in your book.
Oh, I probably did. Yeah, I'm consistent. I was born and raised in Greenville, South Carolina. Grew up in a Christian home. First 7 years, private school, blessed. I mean, my dad had like the third largest landscaping company in Greenville County back then. That was before your Lowe's and Home Depot's and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to public school in eighth grade and had quite a few issues with peer pressure.
Now, were you a big boy back then?
But yeah, I was already bigger. Like probably when I was like, I don't know, 11, I'm already hanging out with like 14-year-olds, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sprouting up. But I knew the difference between right and wrong. If somebody would dare you to do something, and I'd be like, I'm not doing that. I'll get kicked out of school. And they're like, chicken? And I'm like, well, I'm not a chicken. I might be a lot of things, but I'm not a daggum chicken. I'll do it right now. And then I'm sitting in the principal's office when my parents show up, and I go, hey, call me a chicken. I'm not a chicken dick. So yeah, I went to high school at Eastside High School in Greenville, South Carolina. Played ball, wrestled a little bit, played basketball, and then I went to Charleston Southern University. It used to be Baptist College of Charleston, and I was part of the crew that took it to university and Division I play football. And then I came out with a major in criminal justice, minor in psychology, and had a chance to get into law enforcement.
So what position did you play in football?
Lineman. I personally believe I was way better at defense, and I love defense, but somewhere around my senior year in high school, whenever started helping on the offensive line.
Tackle, guard?
I was a tackle, but like when I got to college, anything but center. I tried center. I got nothing but respect for centers, man. I'm like, not center, like S-I-N-N-E-R, football center, because I'm like, wait, you want me to hike the ball as I'm getting my head drilled down my neck and I'm still moving? I'm like, I can't. That I can't do. But, yeah, I got a call to go to college, and I was an offensive lineman. Now, I was a tackle, but I think I got up to about 290-something at 6'4". But, I mean, they were bringing in, like, 6'10", 350-pound dudes, so I just moved down to guard.
Wow.
Just keep moving down. If I'd have kept going, I probably would have been a tight end or something, but.
You remember when the fridge came out in NFL and he was 300 pounds and that was just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. He went to Clemson and he's a South Carolina boy. I used to go watch him on Saturdays at Clemson University. My stepdad graduated from Clemson, so he had he was part of that IPTA club, whatever their booster club thing is, so we went to every home game.
Very nice. You know, but now you look at the NFL, if you're not over 300 pounds, you're not on the line anymore.
And fast. I mean, I remember going against – like, I played against Robert Porche. He was at South Carolina State University, and I remember you getting all wrapped up in your head. You're like, yes, all right, man, the bigger they are, the harder they fall kind of thing. And it's like the ball gets hiked, and I'm like, where did the guy go? What happened?
He was right here.
And then I'm picking up my quarterback going, so he's fast and strong. And I'm like – it's going to be a long day. I'll buy you a steak. And then I think the next year I see him starting. He played for the Detroit Lions. And I'm like, hey, I got my butt kicked by that guy. I know. I got a couple of good licks in out of the, you know, maybe like 3 out of 100. I don't know.
That's the ones we'll concentrate on.
Yeah, I know. That's when I talk smack right after that one. That's right, that's right, boy. That's all you want, some more of that? And the next play I get handed to me. But yeah, it was good times, man.
Did you get a scholarship to go to college?
I got money. It wasn't like a full ride or anything, but I got money. Coming out of college, I had like 4 lanes I was looking at. I'm a musician and a singer. The band I was in had been signed a contract at a studio. So I had that route, had football. I did get some scout combine letters, but I wasn't nothing. I wasn't anything special. I was getting like, there was a couple of NFL teams on there, but it would have mainly been like, it would have been like World League, Canadian League. Mm-hmm. And then I was being recruited for professional wrestling stuff. And it was law enforcement, but I was, even then at a young age, I was a realist. I mean, back then there was no it used to be a WCW power plant or WWE performance center. They didn't have things like that. You just worked the circuit. And I knew a lot about it. I mean, I was a huge fan, but when I was bouncing, they used to come to the club I was a lead bouncer at, and those were avenues, but I stuck with law enforcement. However, here I am at 54 years old, and I was just at a WWE event the other night backstage hanging out with friends, and I still play, and I'm like, well, I never really stopped those two. But, yeah, it's been good. I've had a good time, and I still am. So there.
It's your life is very interesting, and there's parts of it, like you said, playing music that, you know, you look at somebody like you and what you've done, and you don't expect them to have that capability and that talent. But we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. So nobody that's a compliment. That's a Southern compliment.
I'm like, I think. Yeah.
Bless your little heart, right? Everybody knows what that means. Is there anybody in law enforcement in your family?
None. I'm first. I'm first four-year degree, first law enforcement.
Good for you, man.
Unless I don't know. I mean, we went down some genealogy chain. I'm picturing mine weren't law enforcement.
You know, I grew up in Tennessee and West Virginia. Our family tree is kind of like that.
Yeah.
Not a lot of branches on it.
I told somebody other last week, somebody from West Virginia, and I said, you know how I know y'all got rednecks in West Virginia? And he said, how? I said, because the rednecks in South Carolina used to tell redneck jokes about West Virginia.
I may have steal that one from you.
I know, right. We might be bad, but we're not that bad. Yeah.
That's not a competition, but yes, it is. It's always a competition.
But if it was, I think we're winning that one. I don't know.
Oh, well. One of these cases you talked about in Tennessee that we're going to get to with all the opioids. Mm-hmm. West Virginia gave you a run for your money on that one.
Yes, sir. That was bad stuff.
Yeah. And we're going to get to it. Just talk a little bit about your career there with the Sheriff's Department in Greenville. You joined in 93. Is that right out of college?
Yeah. Well, I had roughly that almost a year. I finished my last 2 years in college. I had a 3.8 average, and I was playing NCAA football, and I wasn't taking like easy stuff, but I had a good note-taking system, and that's what I did. I took notes, got to know my instructors or professors, and then I was doing well. But when I came out of college in like early 93, I guess, mm-hmm. I applied with North Charleston Police Department, Charleston County. There's another one in there. It might have been like Berkeley County and then Greenville County Sheriff's Office. And most of the places I was talking to, they were like, man, we'd love to have you, but they weren't hiring white guys. And I'm like, well, that'd have been awesome to know before I majored in this and came out.
Did you ever think about going out of state?
No, I wasn't that smart. Look, man, I was almost like a flat earther. Not really, but I mean, you know what I mean? Like outside of South Carolina, what's wrong with you?
That's the end of the world. You just fall off the edge.
Is there anything outside of South Carolina?
Well, even in West Virginia, there's a state law that you have to visit Myrtle Beach once a year to maintain your citizenship in West Virginia. So that's where everybody goes.
Definitely my stomping grounds. And then you got like the Pigeon Forge area in Tennessee, mm-hmm. which is referred to as Myrtle Beach of the Mountains.
There you go.
Same rides. Same Redneck gorilla on the building. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's a good one.
I love it. So now typically in a sheriff's office, when you first get hired, you have to work the jail, don't you? Did you have to do that?
No, because our jail was run by a third party. The sheriff didn't have the control of the jail, which was fine with me. Because
it's probably fine with him.
Yeah, after bouncing, I didn't want to go work in a jail.
That would never be me.
Yeah, I'm like,
nothing against the correctional officers. God bless you guys, but that's not me.
Yeah, I wanted to be a cop, you know.
Yeah,
uniform patrol at that point in time.
And so you go out and patrol. What'd you think about that when you got out there?
I loved it. Yeah. Loved it, man. It's crash course learning. And that gift of gab, it really came into play. And, you know, I kind of had it anyway growing up. It's my personality, the jovial connecting kind of guy, that kind of personality, which doesn't always work, but most of the time it does. But, yeah, when you're out there and you don't have backup for 45 minutes away and you're in somebody's home and they're clearly dangerous, one of those deals where you're looking and you're going, if I did get hurt or killed, they're not going to find out for a while. I don't even know if anybody will know where I'm at.
It's scary stuff. And having that gift of gab and plus your size, that helps a lot getting you out of situations.
Yeah, I've used it to my advantage. Yeah, for sure.
That's a tribute. You know, it's something, I mean, you employ the gifts that the good Lord gave us. And
yeah,
that's a couple of them. But then after, I think you did 3 years in patrol. Is that right?
Yes.
And where'd you go next?
Got a slot on the Northern Command Vice Narcotics Squad. And that's where I started cutting my teeth. And I had some great mentors, actually, that took me under their wing. And then at some point, I did go back. There was a little snafu with the supervisor and a bad evaluation and stuff, but they didn't have anything to back it up. Long story short, I fought it. I won. So I went back to uniform for about 2 months. And then I went to Southern Command Narcotics, and we just kicked ass down there. It was awesome. Southern Command was just great.
How many sworn people did the SO have, Sheriff's Office have?
That's a good question. For some reason, 300 jumped out of my head, but I know it's more than that. I might be thinking of my high school. I don't know. It's a big county in South Carolina, and it was nationally accredited way back then. So
yeah,
it was legit. We had Johnny Mac Brown was my sheriff. He was like the longest running sheriff, I think, in South Carolina.
Wow. It was a beautiful town. I told you on the phone that my dad went to Bob Jones University. There's a seminary from there. Actually became a Methodist minister and did that for a couple of years and switched over to Southern Baptist. So yeah. My sister and I, our upbringing was a little tough.
A little strict, I imagine.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But you know what?
Girl, is that an ankle showing? You better cover that thing up.
That's it, bro. That 3 inches below the knee.
You're like, woof.
My sister... She was 8 years older than me. So the day she turned 18, she moved out. She had never worn pants in her life until she moved out of the house.
Yeah. I've got both ends of that story. I've got the being around them where they're really strict, that almost that free will Baptist where it's like no drinking, no smoking, no dancing.
Yeah.
And then I've also got the stories where we're all having a party at the house. A buddy brings over a girl he's taken out. And she's from Bob Jones, and we're all like, all right, man, no cussing, cut off the metal music, we're doing this. And she walks in, and I mean, she starts dropping F, but I'm like, you got sent to Bob Jones by your parents to try to straighten you out. I'm like, forget everything I just said. This is a wild one, man. And then we're having to calm her down through the night. Hey.
She was the party.
Yeah, easy, easy. I think it's time to take you back to Bob Jones and drop you off.
Yeah, but it is a beautiful town. In my book, it's a typical... what you might picture of a southern town.
Yeah, but have you been there in the last several years, what they've done to downtown?
No.
Oh, it's unbelievable, man. It is. They moved the semi-pro baseball stadium down at the Reedy River, so it's downtown.
Wow.
The cops still block off Main Street for the weekend. I mean, people go to Greenville just downtown and stay there for the 3 or 4 days because it's all shops and restaurants and bars, and, I mean, they've really done a number. Wow. And a lot of places are trying to copy it, so...
Nice. That's being progressive.
Yeah.
Now, in narcotics, what's your role? Are you an undercover or what do you do in narcotics?
We did both. I went to the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy in Columbia, and I got certified in undercover. Well, I took the 1 week course. You get undercover techniques and then technical surveillance and all that stuff. But we did everything. Like, you're going to be running sources, which you didn't do that in uniform. So now you're learning. You're starting to cut your teeth on what it's like to develop sources, run them, document them, things we have to do to make sure it's airtight in court if it goes to trial. But to me, that always played hand in hand with undercover because the source essentially is doing what I do. They're wearing the wire. They're wearing the recording device. They're getting the evidence. It's just that we're operating them. And most likely, they're definitely not a bonded law enforcement officer, but most likely they have a felony on their record already anyway. But I've always used that to kind of work with sources and you know, boost them up mentally and their self-esteem to say, look, man, you're doing the same thing I do. When I go out of town here next week, that's what I'm going to be doing in this place I'm going. Mm-hmm. But then you start learning your street-level narcotics, your weights, and you learn everything, how to process it, how to do all that. And I started doing some street level buys and stuff. And then also you did device side. I do remember and I first started with them doing like vice roundups. I'm trying to remember what town. It's a part of Greenville County. It's near the city, but you have like Poe Mill, these little sublets. Maybe it was City View. Man, I mean, we go in there and we do a run through as the Johns and we pick up all the prostitutes, get them locked up, and then we put our girls on the corner and start grabbing the Johns, right? It was so eye-opening to me. Man, Steve, I'm like, dude, that's a preacher. Oh, man, that's an elected official. That's it. And I'm like, I also thought, not saying it's right, but, and I grew up in a Christian home, and I'm a Christ follower. I ain't trying to preach, but I'm definitely straight. I'm like, if I would have known in high school that for $20 I could have come over here, I'm like, well, I'm not sure.
A lot of money over there.
I'm not sure I'd have made the right decision. I'm not sure I'd have made the right decision. I was like, who knew this was going on right around the corner? This is crazy.
Yeah, mom and dad probably know, but they didn't want you to know.
Yeah, I know, right?
That's
funny. What are you spending all your money on, Scott? I don't know.
Just out with the guys. That's it. So how long do you do undercover work before you decide? And what was the helped you decide that you wanted a change of pace for you?
So I did not know. I thought that I was later in my career when I decided I wanted to be a Fed. But I'm somewhere I was moving or something or tearing down my office to move to another office or retiring. And I found a note somewhere in my thing from my sheriff's office days. And I said, I wrote it down. I'm going to be a federal agent in 5 years. I do not remember thinking that. I don't know. Wow. It's very prophetic though, but I was working narcotics at Southern Command and we were doing a surveillance one day and I was in the car with my sergeant, Sergeant Kellett, former Marine, Popeye forearms, Fu Manchu, looked like a bulldog in real life, a human bulldog.
Yeah.
And he told me, he said, on that squad, they had nicknamed me Kingpin. He said, Kingpin, I'll tell you right now, if I was single and I had a 4-year degree like you, I'd apply to be an FBI agent and I'd put New York as my first office. And I was like, you got to be absolutely insane. And I didn't know the FBI did all that. I mean, I'd seen them at some roundups. Of course, I'd seen them at bank robberies. I had no idea that they worked everything. Mm-hmm. And I started looking into it and I was told that it was the hardest to get hired with and I put in for it. And DEA form was next. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was maybe Marshall's after that. I never had a chance to fill out the other ones because every time I would fill out a section or I put in my application, they contact you. Now you're getting ready for phase one. So you're studying and studying and studying. You're trying to get ready for phase one. You pass phase one and you're like, hey, let me fill out. No, it's time for a psychological, your psychological or your polygraph or your PT test. Then mm-hmm. It's phase two. And I got picked up. My EOD at Quantico day one was 9/27 of 98. I showed up at Quantico.
Isn't it amazing how you remember those dates?
Well, yeah. Yeah. And then, oddly enough, I know it's different at DEA, but because we were talking earlier, when I went through in 98, DEA was using Quantico as well. Like, I mean, you're in Quantico, but they didn't have their own
Academy
facilities. Right. Yeah. You were housed in one of our, was it Madison or Washington that you guys were in?
It was the older one, not the newer one.
Okay. Well, Jefferson's the brand new one. And then there was Madison and Washington. I can't remember, but one of those DEA used, but I was a cookie cutter in DEA, man. I was trained. I'm like, we'd go to the gym. I'd lift with all the DEA guys and gals because, I mean, former football player, former cop. And I'd be sitting in the sauna or in the gym. And they'd be like, what's a big old country boy like you doing with the FBI? You need to come over here to the DEA. And we'd josh and go back and forth. But, yeah.
You tell me, the FBI needed a token Southern boy. I mean, that's with me, the DEA needed a token hillbilly. I am.
I'm like, so for the FBI to get at your field office, there's 56 field offices and you list them in the order you want them. And that's the most ridiculous thing. To this day, I still think it's like, I sweat over that thing. You'd go to bed and you'd wake up from dead sleep going, nope, I had that too high. I need to change that around as if it matters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause I'm like, look, just let me list my top 10. And if you're not going to give me my top 10, you're going to send me wherever you want to anyway. Don't make me suffer through this.
Yeah.
And I think I worked my way up the East Coast and I ended way the farthest out. Cause I was kind of thinking, stay close to family kind of thing. And I think New York was 36 on my list. So we had this deal where everybody puts money in a kitty or a pot. And then whoever gets six, if whatever their 56 out of 56 was, if they get it, they get the pot. We had six 56s.
No kidding.
And it was all New York City, and two of them quit the next day. So four people got to split the pot, but it was 36 on my list. So when I went back from my going away party, I told the sergeant, I said, man, you jinxed me, you sucker. I'm like, not only did I get hired, I got New York City, dadgummit.
Yeah, it was good. When I read that in your book, I thought, man, you got to put down everyone. We put down five.
Yeah, and that's what it should be.
One of those five had to be a division office. So, yeah, I put Miami down, and that was number five, and that's where I went.
But you guys could trade off though, right? I mean, I don't know if it happened that way when you went through, but they would explain to me, like, if I got Miami and you got South Carolina, well, DEA, they're not going to use a drug agent. Right. With the FBI, they might be hiring you for accountant background, lawyer, whatever, foreign language. But you guys could say, like me and you, I say, hey, Steve, I really wanted South Carolina. And you know what, Scott, I really wanted Miami. And we could get it approved and switch our transfer.
Yeah, I think later I came through in 87 in the academy. 6'7", okay. 87 was the entry date. And I think later on they did. But even like now, my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, we get to go to the academy twice a year to talk to the BATs, the trainees, and tell our little story. And they actually know before they get hired now where they're going to be stationed. Which when I went through, you found out 2 weeks before you graduated.
Yeah. So you know what? I was put on training last week and the guy was telling me. It was a guy going through our class. He was pretty new FBI agent. And he said that now you're definitely finding out a heck of a lot quicker. It would just shock me how many people would be like, well, I didn't know I wasn't going to get to go home. I'm like, are you kidding me? They tell you that from day one. Like if I process out of Columbia, South Carolina, which I did, that's a smaller office in the South. It's hard to get. There's no way I'm getting back to Columbia.
Exactly.
Unless it's some kind of hardship with a family thing or a kid, mutual custody kind of thing. But I mean, if you're from New York or LA and you say, I want to go to LA, you might luck out and get that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I knew I wouldn't, but I will say out of 50 something students in my class on orders night, I was in the last like seven people to get called up to read my orders. And the way it goes at the FBI Academy on orders night, people come in, they line the walls because it's funny to them. And you got to walk up and you got your orders in your hand and you say, hey, I'm Scott Payne. I'm from Greenville, South Carolina. My number one choice is this. This is what I think I'm going to get. So by the time it got to me, I'd seen some people get New Orleans, Philly. I'm like, well, that's closer. I mean, I put Philly down. I saw like Baltimore. I'm like, oh, I got those. Maybe there's a chance. So I walked up and I said, hey, Scott Payne, Greenville, South Carolina, my number one choice is whatever, Jacksonville, Florida, whatever I put down. And I said, and where do I think I'm going? I said, it hadn't been looking too good for the Southern boys, man. And I opened it up and I went, the Big Apple. Whoa. So at orders night party, you start off, you're like, woo, I'm going to New York City. Heck yeah, buy me another one, Jack and Coke on me. Yeah, about midnight, I was going to New York City. Yeah. I'm like, I got a Basset Hound. I got a straight drive standard cab 4x4 with a shotgun rack. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do up there.
I'm not sure I'm going to fit in up there.
Be all right.
It's amazing. It just, I've never understood the thought process about how they pick where people are going. I mean, it turned out to be a blessing for Miami, but
same here. I mean, they're still saying it today. I guess it just stayed with all the tradition, but we always said they got a drunk monkey blindfolded back there throwing a dart. And wherever it lands, that's where you're going. Who knows? Just point. Pin the tail on the donkey. All right, Scott, you're going to Baghdad.
When I read that about you, I'm thinking McCloud. Remember the old TV show?
Yeah. That was a good look, by the way.
Yeah.
Cowboy hat, blazer, tucked in shirt, blue jeans with cowboy boots.
You fit right in, don't you?
That's good stuff right there.
I like it. I like it. So you get up to New York City now. What do they have you assigned to?
Well, in New York, that's our biggest field office. So in the FBI, they do a rotation. So you don't just get to go to the squad you're going to go to, as if you got like Knoxville or even Miami or Birmingham or something like that. Any of those offices, you're going to go straight to a squad. In New York, you start off on the rotation on an applicant squad. They had two. One of them did interviews of new applicants. The other one did interviews for 5-year reinvestigations and presidential appointees. I ended up on that one. So that was kind of cool because, I mean, you're in New York City and here I'm a country boy from South Carolina. And it might be a presidential appointee, and I get to go interview Paul Newman. Or way back then, you might get to go interview Donald Trump before he was the current day Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, I mean, that was pretty cool. So now while you're doing that, you're learning the city. They give you a placard, but nobody tells you the ins and outs. I live 10 miles door to door away. I lived right on the river in New Jersey, drove through the Lincoln Tunnel every day down the West Side Highway. And even after rush hour, it still took an hour and a half to get there. So I did like 3 or 4 months on the applicant squad. Then you do like 2 weeks in the operations center. And then you go to one of the like 16 surveillance squads. So I was on that for like 2 or 3 months. But what I was doing, and you know, what you should do, I was on the same floor as the drug branch on the 22nd floor. It was the drug branch and the organized crime branch. And I just went over there and kind of pawned myself out the drug squads. Like they were doing arrests all the time. Cause before 9/11, you had a drug branch. I mean, you had an ASAC over multiple. You had the HIDA squad, which is high intensity drug trafficking area, which I know you know that one.
Yeah.
We had a Colombian drug squad. We had a Dominican drug squad. We had an Italian drug squad, an Asian drug squad. C-33 was like a catch-all of black gangs and stuff like that. So there were arrests happening all the time, and I would volunteer. I'd be the first one there, last one to leave, put me on a perimeter. You want me to stay around and fingerprint, I'll do that. I'm just trying to pay my dues. And when my orders came up, I was actually going to be sent to Foreign Counterintelligence, FCI, Foreign Counterintelligence. And I was like, boof, man. And luckily, the supervisor over the applicant squad, Harold Brantley, he took a bullet. Basically, he went in there and he said, I don't argue for everybody. He said, but you got this all wrong. This guy should be working drugs. And when they reached out to the ASAC, I'd worked with so many squads and I'd already done a couple of internal documents saying I'd really like to work on the drug squad. Here's my background and why. And as soon as they called him, he was like, oh yeah, we'd love to have Scott. So divine intervention, man. But I ended up on the Colombian drug squad.
Wow.
The sister squad, the Jack Garcia, who you mentioned earlier when we were talking. Yeah. Jack Garcia was on the sister Colombian drug squad across the bridge in Brooklyn, Queens.
How about that? Now, where was your office in New York City?
26 Fed.
All right.
Yeah, I was right there, man. 26 Fed.
I forgot to ask you, when you were in the academy, we've all been through police academies. There's always funny things that go on that you remember the rest of your life. You got any good stories from the academy days? Doesn't have to be about you. It could be about some of the other people.
Probably not the craziest during that time, because my class was actually scared to go to the boardroom and drink because we thought we were all being watched. We'd go off base. Which was way safer.
That way you can drive back drunk instead of drunk.
And dodge like 400 deer on the way back in the pitch black. You remember? They got the sign, like, what number of deer have been killed that year?
Yep.
I mean, we were up there like 300. Yeah, 300 something. So I'm like, that gun. And then if an MP stops you and you say, hey, man, it's cool. I'm FBI agent training. That's not cool.
Yeah.
Not cool. But here's one that I figured out. It was after Quantico. But I went back to a training. And it was a drug enterprise seminar. And by about day three, it hit me. I have not stepped foot outside into fresh air in 3 days because it's one big biodome. It's one big gerbil tunnel. Like you go from your room to breakfast to class to lunch to class to the gym to your room to the bar and back. And you never even walk outside. And not that I did it, but I'm going to tell you, about night three, I'm paying attention. You go to the boardroom and everybody gets hammered and smashed and there's all some kind of party or something going on and they close the doors at 10 or 10:30. Well, everybody's walking back to their rooms and people just start diving into rooms together. And I'm like, well, this is really a bad foundation. I'm like, you got everybody trapped. You got everybody drinking. They're in Quantico land, which is not reality.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to conga line it right back to the room, man. I'm like, so, but yeah, there's all kinds of fun stuff that happened at Quantico, but the boardroom stories, the old boardroom before they made the new one.
Just go in there and do the aircraft landing on the tables, clear the tables off and pour beer on them.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty stupid. I mean, well, I heard people did that. I'm not saying I did that.
I can either confirm or deny.
I have no recollection.
And I don't condone that kind of activity.
Were you in New York City when 9/11?
I was assigned. I was still an agent assigned to New York City, but the day of 9/11, I was undercover in San Antonio, Texas, on a full-time undercover. So as soon as I could, actually, that's what's over my shoulder right here. That's the hard hat from Ground Zero. That's what they gave us, a hard hat with a Sharpie pen that says NYPD, JTTF, and then that mask right there. I mean, that's what you mow your lawn in. That's what they gave us, thankfully. For me, I wasn't at the sites long enough to develop anything bad. I am on that email chain of all former agents who have been there and exposed, and I've lost some friends. that develop cancers from working those sites. But that's the patch. It can go on a vest or whatever, but 9/11, and that is a Port Authority riot gear hat. So yeah, as soon as I could fly, I went back.
Yeah. You and I have another mutual friend that you wrote about in the book that 9/11 took him, Dave LaValle.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the Colombian Drug Squad. That was Dave. Everybody kind of had their cliques. And again, I was the brand new guy, but Dave was such a solid, good dude. And we did cross paths throughout our career because he ended up being over the Transnational Organized Crime Squad. And a case I was running ended up getting like top 20 cases in the bureau or something. Anyway, we stayed in touch, and a real good friend of Dave's was Greg Erie. And I still talk to Greg Erie. Mm. It was just sad, man. Because he became SAC of Atlanta, I think, before he passed.
Last time I saw him, my partner and I were down there doing a show in Atlanta. And he actually came to the show with his wife. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
We didn't start off on a real good foot, just because I was battling with Bureau headquarters and through the OSDEF Fusion Center. But when I retired, he was the only FBI agent that came to my retirement. And he came and presented me with a certificate, probably a certificate of appreciation from the FBI director.
The director, Mueller?
This was in 13, so I'll be honest with you, I don't remember. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds right, because he got extended 2 years. Yeah, it would have been him or Comey.
I remember seeing both of those guys when I was in headquarters, because I was SAC over the DEA Office of Special Intel, which was all classified, and then had the OSDEF Fusion Center for a few years there.
Yeah, Dave's a solid. He may rest in peace, but he was definitely a solid man.
He was.
Good. He reminds me of like some friends I've had through the years that I call my barometer. You know what I mean? Never like blowing, never like overly angry or losing control. Just nice and calm. And you could go to him and say, look, we really want to go beat this guy up. What do you think? He's that kind of guy. He'd be like, well, I mean,
let's talk about this.
And you go, all right, you're right, man. Or he might be like, something about that fella just isn't right. And we'd be like, that means a yes. That means we can go with this guy. I knew it.
Yeah.
He was just a good dude, man. Great case agent too.
For our listeners, Dave contracted whatever the dust and everything was from 9/11, and that's what eventually took his life. So
one of those cancers. Yeah.
Sorry to hear that. Rest in peace, brother.
Yeah.
All right. So that's in 2001. Now, when you joined JTTF later in your career, so
yeah, I did a little stint. I did a little stint in McAllen, Texas, when they created JTTF. Not that I wanted to work it. Mm-hmm. It's just that at that point in my career in McAllen, Texas, I was more concerned about who I was working for than what I was working. Because it was a pretty toxic environment down there for a while. Not so much amongst the agents. That was really cool. Because when I first got to McAllen, I mean, it was so close-knit with basically all federal agencies. And it could be Friday afternoon, and we'd be like, hey, I'm thinking about having a cookout. Really? All right, next thing you know, you got like 30 people at your house.
That's all it took.
Cook a pig or something. That was really cool, but it was a toxic working environment there as far as management went. Matter of fact, it was so bad that even though I was already an agent, I was talking to DEA, and I was looking at switching over because I was like, I know I got to go back through Quantico, which will suck, but can I at least keep my pay? And they were like, yeah. And then I'm not a knee-jerk reaction guy. After several weeks of looking at it, and then I guess I was young in my career. It's just that I started realizing that nothing stays the same forever, good or bad. Mm-hmm. And I knew that our undercover program was different. I knew that we had a SWAT team in every division, and I'm a tactical guy as well. So I ended up staying and riding it out. And it ended up being the right thing for me.
Yeah. I think you probably made the right decision too. I love DEA until the day I die, but I think you were in a good spot there.
Yeah.
And just so if you would tell our listeners what JTTF stands for and what they kind of look at.
So Joint Terrorism Task Force, I think it was created in the 80s, but it really blew up after 9/11. It essentially, you're going to work international terrorism violations and weapons of mass destruction. So if you have a bomb tech, which we do in every division, that bomb tech is going to be your WMD and working it off of JTTF. But that's the three main things right there.
Got it. And we'll get back to that here just shortly. Actually, we'll probably get back to it tomorrow. But now, I think you're still in New York in September 2002, and you decide you wanted to try the FBI undercover school.
I had transferred. So October of 2001, my transfer was made official. So to McAllen, Texas.
Okay.
So it was a specialty undercover transfer because I was listed as a full-time undercover for that San Antonio case. The option that the management gave me is our undercover operations, the renewal process is every 6 months. So I'd already been listed. I'd already been there full-time. So on the renewal was a cost transfer for me to San Antonio because we didn't know how long this case was going to go, and it's a specialty undercover transfer. But the option that was given to me was I couldn't stay in San Antonio proper because it was a foreign counterintelligence case. Only one I ever worked undercover, really, I think. Definitely is the primary long term. Mm-hmm. But I was told I could pick any RA I wanted, any satellite office I wanted. And a lot of people were like, why didn't you pick Austin? And I was still trying to get back to the Southeast. And to my knowledge, at that point in time, Austin didn't even have a drug squad. Hmm. And I'd already worked with several people on the border, and I was driven down there and checked it out. And I'm like, this is cool because it's all in the eye of the beholder. I mean, like, you're in New York City. I'm not hating on New York. I had a blast there, but I get to McAllen. And at that point in time, I think the cost of living increase for New York was only 13%. Mm-hmm. Well, I get to McAllen, Texas on the border, and it's 11%. And I'm like, hey, don't get me wrong. I am very happy. But if I get 11 here, I should have got like 25 or 30 up there. Yeah. Easy.
Yeah.
But you get these crazy things that you couldn't get in New York City, like central heat and air, like a parking spot, you know, a washer and dryer hookup. Don't even worry about the washer and dryer. You just actually have a hookup that you can go buy a washer and dryer for. So I got down there. I married my wife, and we started our family there. But, yeah, I was in McAllen as of October of 2001.
I was down there just – Javier and I were down there a couple months ago, and I was surprised. I'd never been to McAllen before. I'm just thinking some dirty, sleepy, dusty border town, man. It was nice.
It's not a hardship by any means, but it's hard to staff.
Yeah.
And that's what got me my transfer later on. They came out with a new policy that says if you've done five or more years in a hard-to-staff office, you name where you want to go and you trump everybody. So by the time that policy came out, I'd already had 6.5 years in McAllen. So that's when I immediately just that policy came out on Monday. Tuesday, my paperwork was in to go to Tennessee. So,
were you a GS-13 when you went to McAllen?
No. I forget how many steps. So I know you're a 10-something in the academy. Then it's bumped. Then you jump to like an 11-3. I definitely wasn't a 13-10. I might have already been a 13, though. At least a 13-1, right? Because as long as you don't screw up, in 5 years, you'll be a 13-1. And that's something I looked at when I was looking at applying. Mm-hmm. Because going back to the sheriff's office, when I came in as a brand new deputy with a 4-year degree, the same thing happened to me 4 to 5 years later. My 3-striper that was training me was extremely pissed off, and they let me know every day that I was making almost as much money as them because county council would never raise your pay, but they would raise the hiring rate.
Yeah.
So it was ass backwards because at some point I could have literally walked out of the sheriff's office, applied back, and I'd have been making as much, if not more money.
That's crazy.
But that was the big thing that the senior people taught me. Where are you going to be in 5 years? So when I looked at the feds, especially FBI, I'm like, as long as I don't screw up in 5 years, I'm a GS-13 step one. And that's decent money.
Very, especially when you get the availability pay, it goes with it.
Yeah.
Which for those that don't know, that's 25% bump on whatever your base pay is. So it's kind of automatic, but if that means if you have to work 100 hours a week, you work 100 hours a week and that's all you get.
Yeah. I was going to say, it always sounds great. You're going to pay me 25% on top of my pay. That sounds awesome until you do an 80 or 100 hour week. And you're like, man, if you'd have just given me straight time, not even time and a half, not double time. If you'd just given me straight time during that Outlaws case, I'd have paid everything off.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you're down there. You're already doing undercover. What's this certification school? How come you didn't go to that before you started working undercover?
It's a little weird, and it's hard to get a slot. You end up with only 20 slots in the school. So let's just say hundreds apply. Mm-hmm. And then you go through like a phase 1 test, a phase 2, you go out and then they'll dwindle it down to like 40 people. And 20 of them are backups for the 20 that are chosen. Mm-hmm. And I ended up being a backup. It does help you. There was a couple of ways to get in quick. If you were slated, like let's just say they canvass, they go through the bureau, nobody wants this case, but you've convinced the case team, I'm the person, we want you, but you're not certified. That can help you get a slot in the school quicker. Mm. If you've done one, that can help you get a slot in the school quicker. But on paper, I wasn't jumping out there. I mean, I'm a white guy who didn't really have a good testable foreign language fluence, being fluent in a foreign language. So I get a slot in the school as a backup. And then they called me and they're like, hey, we just had a slot up and up. Do you want in? And at that point in time, my health was not that great. And I was still a little shell shocked. So I prayed about it. I'm like, look, I don't want to go and fail. I know this is a selfish prayer, but if it's not meant to be, please send me a sign because I don't want to go if I'm going to fail. And I went and I passed in 2002. It's a 2-week certification course, no days off, very big on sleep deprivation, building blocks. It's all there. Through the years, things have evolved and changed for the better, especially as a training standpoint, because you've got liability issues and everything. So now, unless something's changed, I retired in June of 21, but every candidate in that school will go through every scenario. In other words, you can't come back and say, you failed me, but my background's drugs and you only put me in foreign counterintelligence stuff, or I'm a person of color and you put me in a white supremacist scenario kind of thing. Everybody goes through every scenario. And we have sharpened our skills. We have world working groups. Any school I participated in, and I started role playing in 2003 up until the time I retired, and I probably missed a handful of schools, but we're working groups. So we sharp at the whole iron sharpens iron thing. I mean, working with MI5, MI6, they're working with us. We're in Poland, they're over here. Any school I did, we always had some outside country either going through it or observing, and then vice versa. We would try to sharpen each other up.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I remember when we had Dane on here, she was talking about going through that school. She's a little bitty thing. She's not 6'4".
Yeah.
And there was some scenario where
she probably did better than me. I attract too much daggum attention.
They put her in some situation. She said she was dog tired and the trunk popped open and she thought they were going to try to kidnap her. And she rammed one of the instructors and knocked him in the trunk and apparently hurt his back. And I guess there was a spare tire or a jack or something in the trunk.
I know exactly which scenario that is because those are back in the Quantico days. I'm not going to say what the whole thing is about, but I will tell you way back in the day, everybody didn't go through every scenario. And that's one of those things I talked about that got better with the school. Yep. Everybody didn't go there. So I might be me and you in the group of five. That's our group. And let's say Dana's going into the undercover. So we're in Hogan's Alley and say it's me and you. It was me and another guy, but it was snowing. We crawl through the woods in the snow. We get up to set up to where we can see. And I mean, about 30 seconds to a minute after the scenario starts, we see a bunch of black dudes carry something out that looks like a body and throw it in the trunk and shut it. And I'm like,
ooh,
I think that might be our undercover in the trunk. They were like, scenario's over, man. Well, that was fast. I'm like, we spent all our time crawling in just to watch somebody get thrown in the trunk. You know?
Oh, geez. You know, I don't want to give away too much about your book. You guys got to read this book here. It's very, very good. But there's a statement I read that you made when you were selected to go to the undercover certification school. And it says, wait, they're going to train us all day in class, keep me up all night doing undercover scenarios, then give me drinks and not let me sleep. What was your reaction to that?
There's two. I've been training for this my whole life.
Yep.
Or I'm in shape for this. I'm good. And I was. I mean, I'm an idiot, and it's not a chest-beating thing at all, but I was the last one to leave. When I went through the UC school, it was the Jopa Stones, and it was those guys that would tell me, hey, we're done. And I would be in the Starlight Bar in Hogan's Alley bagging trash.
Wow. Well, you know, certain people are cut out for certain things. I did undercover, but mine was all short term. I grew up looking like a cop.
Yeah.
You just look at me. But in Miami in the late 80s, people would still buy dope from me.
So a lot of people have misconceptions. They're like, you get those tats for the case? No, this is me. I didn't get a tattoo for a case. I don't have to have tattoos or a goatee to go back. That's the whole NARC thing, right?
Yeah.
You go to the NARC conference, everybody's got a goatee now.
Or the gang conference.
I know, right? Everybody's all jacked up with a straight bill hat walking around, CrossFit gurus. I'm like, you all look like cookie cutters. But what I'm saying is, for me, you don't have to do what I do. You do, I mean, what is your background? In other words, you get a canvas. So we need an Asian male with so-and-so height that speaks Cantonese or something. You're like, okay, we don't have that. What are you trying to do? And you might be able to look at the case and go, well, yeah, but this security guard has access to everything. What if we, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat kind of thing.
Right. But,
you
know,
one thing I'm saying, if you think about it, because skinning a cat would be bad, right? I just heard the words coming out of my mouth. I'm like, that was like animal cruelty.
Yeah, well, that's an old Southern saying, though.
Yeah.
But you see throughout the book that when you're developing your legend, you try to stay as close to who you really are, mm-hmm. especially like the first name. I'm Steve Murphy, and my undercover name was Steve Mitchell, because yeah. everybody calls you Steve.
It's a common name.
Yeah.
Now, if your name was something like Glennis or some weird, I don't know, something that's not mm-hmm. Liberace, maybe you need to change your name.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was always Scott.
Then you go through this school. What when is it that you get involved with motorcycle gang? And which gang was it?
It would have been around 05-ish, mm-hmm. I think, is when we went in to the Outlaws. I'd been recruited for a couple other biker cases, but for whatever reason, they didn't come to fruition. This one came up, and I can't remember if somebody called me or I saw it a canvas on an email, but it was the Outlaws and near Boston, Massachusetts. And I was like, hey, man, I put in for it, and I got flown out. I don't know how many people they interviewed for it, but, I mean, it was very American Idol-ish or America's Got Talent-ish. You know, mm-hmm. yeah, it was weird. It's the only one I've ever done like that. I flew in. You're basically sitting in a chair, rooms full of course, FBI, but task force officers, ATF, a DEA was there. Nancy Morelli was the DEA agent assigned to that outlaw case forever, for the whole time I was on it. But yeah, you ask questions and they're going over what they got and this, that, and the other, and what would be my game plan. And of course it's like, how many biker gangs have you infiltrated? And I'm like, none, but I think that's a plus. I'm like, but I am a biker. I used to bounce establishments mm-hmm. where the Hells Angels frequented in North Charleston, South Carolina. They've actually helped me in fights. I know that culture a little bit. So, and then we talked about what would be, it's kind of like a, hey, what would you do if this was your situation? Would you do this or not? And I'm like, I would rather go in cold. I would rather leave, if you've got somebody that's kind of on the inside, I would rather leave that person off to the side, thinking like, let's talk about Joe Pistone mm-hmm. And Donnie Brasco, right? So I'm like, if this person vouches for me to come in, that's a great in. But if something happens later on and for some reason there's a hit or a beatdown planned on me or somebody's not trusting me, they're probably not going to tell this dude because he's the one that brought me in. However, if that person's over here, I come in cold.
Yeah.
And something like that happens, this person's probably going to find out about it. So it's a safety net is the way I looked at it. And we went with that and they picked me to be the one and it was off to the races from there.
Sounds like you had thought that through before you went in there.
And I just learned it being a narc and being a bouncer and being a people person. And they're like, well, we got these other task force officers here that want to go in with you. Cool, man. Love it. Talking to them. And I'm like, man, I was a narc. Hey, awesome. This ain't not good. But let me ask you something. Do you go to court here? Do you arrest people a good bit here? And you go in for court? Yeah. And I go, how do you plan on going deep undercover? I mean, deep undercover for a long time. So learn this by being a narc. If you send all four of us in together and one of us screws up or they don't like one of us, probably all four of us are out.
Yeah.
But it's a big gang. It's a big club. Run as many as you want at it.
Mm-hmm.
Run you, run me, run them. And then if two of us make it or all four of us make it, great. If we meet each other through the case, that's fine. But that's the way I wanted to go. I thought it would be better to go in cold.
And what was the objective or the focus of that investigation?
So they had all kinds of good evidence about drug deals and stuff like that. A lot of violence, beatdowns, maybe some home invasions. But is it enough to charge? You know how it is. It's like, well, let's find out really what's going on. But you can't just go willy-nilly and start doing undercover or a full-blown operation because you're going to have to show, just like you have to do with the wiretap Title III, you have to show that you've exhausted your means on regular mm-hmm. surveillance and this, that, and the other. And this is why you're doing this very intrusive technique. And they had a lot of good intelligence. And some of it was wrong, but most of it was spot on about certain characters. And really, on a lot of long-term cases that I went in, like if you, okay, person's doing this, we're trying to buy dope. Well, there's your goal. We're going to roll up. We're going to try to buy dope. That's more street level stuff. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to find out inner workings, my main thing in the beginning is just try to build my backstory and ingratiate, to make connections. Like some of the stuff we'll talk about later, like some of those white supremacy groups. Well, a lot of the stuff they're saying online is First Amendment protected, but are they really planning something? Well, we don't know. Let's get on the inside and try to find out. And there's been many cases where I'm in for 5 months and I'm like, I come back to the case team and like, I'm done. And they're like, why? And I go, well, they're not doing nothing. I mean, there's nothing illegal and I'm out. So do that. But yeah, my whole thing was just to kind of start getting to know people and see mm-hmm. what's going on. And that's kind of what happened. I got in, I started going to a bar that they frequented, but I kind of went when they weren't there and just started getting to know, do what I do in a bar. I mean, I was on Rogan's show and Rogan asked me, he said, well, how did you do such and such? I said, I did the same thing I did at the bar last night in Austin. I walked in, I start buying drinks, I start talking to people, I'm making friends, you know, bar friends.
Yeah.
And just hooking up, connecting with people.
Yeah. Were you still living in McAllen while you were working up in Boston?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're married at that time?
Yep. With like a 3 and a 1 year old. Or 2 and a newborn. Yeah. That was
you're heading for the doghouse.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I thought I was doing pretty good, but you know, I wasn't. Yeah. But yeah, that's a whole day of travel, right? And that's something, if you talk about undercover stressors, you're all the way across the United States. Your wife calls you crying, the kid's sick, or the dog got hit by a car or something, and it can't get back home quick. I mean, it's going to take me at least, I mean, a day to get home.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I can FedEx myself overnight, which doesn't happen. You know, that's a heavy box.
What about your motorcycle? Where did you get a motorcycle from up in Boston?
I used a covert bike. We have backstopping and stuff like that. Not to give away.
Yep.
Get deep into tradecraft. But yeah, I'll tell you what, that's a funny story. I thought I had a covert bike. And then I found out, like, after that 2-year case, like 4 or 5 months later, they were like, hey, did you know this thing was a seized bike? And I went, no. I'm like, don't get me wrong. Let me know it's a seized bike and I can talk around that.
You don't let me be surprised.
Right. It's seized. I took it off one of my brothers and I went and bought it in an auction. Yeah, something. Give me something. Yeah. But not let me think I'm riding around on a fully cold bike. And then especially, what if it was a cop bike? You get those. And these guys, they're wrenchers, man. They're in there and they're like changing carburetors for me. They say, you can go under there and see a cop then. Let me know. You know what I mean?
Dang.
I can kind of be prepared and not be standing there with weenie and mono trying to figure it out.
Yep. I read once part where you got pulled over by the cops. What'd you tell them? You tell the story.
It was me and a bunch of outlaws, and we were at the Chili Chowder. That's how they pronounce it there. Chili Chowder Festival. And it was actually good food.
Yeah.
But we're leaving, and a trooper stops us. And he's giving us the riot act a little bit, but he comes around, and I wasn't trying to be a smartass. It's just that it came off my tongue real quick. And I am kind of in roll, you know. And he says, hey, your license plate expired. And I said, I guess you got to take that up with Avis. And he's like, well, I got to say my car. I rented it. I didn't know to check it. But then he kind of browbeats me a little bit. And I'm like, all right. In my mind, I'm like, back off a little bit, boy. You come off a little. Dude, look at who you're in a car with right now. And then he was like, well, what are you doing up here hanging out with all these outlaws kind of thing? And he asked if I was a bandito because I was from Texas. I go, banditos and outlaws don't get along. I said, hell, they're my friends. But the way it played is we get to the next bar setting and they're like, you should have heard Tex. He told that effing trooper.
Yeah.
He told him, he was like, you need to check with Avis for that. And I'm like,
you just build credibility.
Well, I played well, but I could have been easily had my face on the hood of a car.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which I think you did later on, but we'll talk about that here.
Yeah, I've done that a few times too.
We've been going about an hour here, Scott. So if it's okay with you, we'll call it quit to this episode. Ladies and gentlemen, there's still more to this outlaw story, and there's still several more stories we're going to go through. So you got to come back tomorrow. Again, thank you for coming and supporting me every week. I appreciate you. We're on Mondays and Tuesdays every week. Occasionally it's on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and sometimes it's only on Monday. It just depends on the guest that we have on the show. But appreciate you continuing to support us. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Scott, thank you, brother. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'll be
Thanks,
back.
Everyone.